From NPR and WBUR, I'm Peter O'Dowd.
I'm Femi Okeh. It's Here and Now. It's been a busy week in politics, capped by a Democratic presidential candidates debate last night on ABC News, where moderates and progressives sparred over hot-button topics like Medicare for All and lower-tier candidates such as Pete Buttigieg and Julian Castro tried to stand out.
This is why presidential debates are becoming unwatchable.
Yeah.
This reminds everybody of what they cannot stand about Washington. Scoring points against each other, poking at each other, and telling each other that you're my plan, your plan. Look, we all
That's called a Democratic primary election. That's called an election.
All right, let's get to it with our Friday Politics Roundtable. Beth Fooey is senior politics editor at NBC. Hi, Beth.
Hi.
Hey, and Juana Summers, national political reporter for the Associated Press. Juana, good to have you back.
Hey there.
And let's start with you, Juana. This was the third debate now between Democrats. Many of the same topics came up, but this was also pretty lively, as we just heard there. What did you learn from last night's debate?
It was absolutely quite lively, but I don't think that we saw anything on stage that fundamentally changed the shape of the race. Former Vice President Joe Biden, despite a couple of stumbles, I think comes out largely in the same place he was as the front runner, with candidates like Elizabeth Warren of Massachusetts and Bernie Sanders of Vermont kind of nipping at his heels. We saw a really interesting and I think thoughtful debate over health care for about the first 30 minutes between those two candidates who represent both the moderate and liberal extremes on that debate that I think was actually really telling him one of the best exchanges that we saw of any of these three debates.
Beth, what was your headline from the debate last night?
Yeah, I'd agree with Juana that it's pretty much the field is pretty much in the same place as it was ahead of the debate. Joe Biden did well enough that the fundamental dynamics of the race have not changed. He did not stumble significantly. He held his own. He parried with some of his opponents in a more effective way than we've seen him in the past. But I would say just so many issues came up and so many discussions took place that are really been unprecedented up till now in presidential debates. The fact, for example, that Beto O'Rourke spoke about repossessing people's assault weapons, not something you could ever have envisioned, you know, 4 or even 8 years ago. This discussion of Medicare for All as a legitimate topic for discussion among Democratic voters, also quite astonishing. Pete Buttigieg describing on national television his journey to coming out as gay. Again, none of these things we could have imagined seeing on a Democratic debate or any debate for that matter in a presidential contest until now.
Well, let's hear some of the tape. You mentioned Beto O'Rourke. Here he is on that line about AR-15 and confiscating guns.
Hell yes, we're going to take your AR-15, your AK-47. We're not going to allow it to be used against our fellow Americans anymore.
Juana, that got a big applause, but less than an hour later, a Texas state representative tweeted in response, "My AR is ready for you, Robert Francis." O'Rourke took that as a death threat. Look, no matter where you stand on this issue, that was a bold statement on O'Rourke's part.
It absolutely was, and this is a candidate who we have seen reset his campaign and then make gun control a central platform in his bid for the presidency. He has been outspoken and using profanities, even as many news organizations have noted, in talking about the paralysis here in Washington and inability to pass new gun legislation that would stop shootings like the one that we saw in his hometown of El Paso that killed 22 people. This is certainly going a step further. It's a sentiment that certainly would not be popular among many gun owners, even some of those there in Texas, the idea of taking these guns back. But he is certainly trying to revive his campaign and making this really a defining issue. And I think he had a pretty good night doing it.
Beth, we did a deep dive into the Democratic candidates' various different healthcare policies, how they're different from each other. Here's Joe Biden.
My friend from Vermont thinks that the employer is going to give you back if you negotiated his union all these years, got a cut in wages because you got insurance. They're going to give back that money to the employee?
Matter of fact, they will.
Well, let me tell you something. For a socialist, you got a lot more confidence in corporate America than I do.
Beth, is it becoming clearer how the various different candidates are managing healthcare? Are they changing their positions at all or digging down?
Well, so we see some candidates in this field really embracing Medicare for all, including Bernie Sanders, who was in that clip that you just played, Elizabeth Warren as well. Kamala Harris is describes herself as pro-Medicare for all, but is a little bit more nuanced on some of the details. Listen, I think a lot of this is kind of background noise for a lot of voters who haven't really tuned in that much yet. Mm-hmm. What most voters care about is which party, which candidate is going to protect my health care and make sure that I have some health care that I can afford and that will protect my pre-existing conditions. And if that answer is one of or more of these specific candidates, or if people believe President Trump is the better person to lead that charge, that's where those voters are going to come down. Sort of the nitty-gritty details that are being hammered out repeatedly on these debate stages probably will clear the way for a more general look at who is the candidate, who is the party best positioned to protect health care.
Well, here's Elizabeth Warren when she was asked whether taxes would go up for the middle class as a result of Medicare for All.
Look, what families have to deal with is cost. Total cost. That's what they have to deal with. And understand, families are paying for their health care today.
With all the key players together for the first time, it seemed like we got a glimpse on this issue of Medicare for All of Sanders and Warren defending that plan sort of against attacks from pretty much everybody else. And just weigh in on that and also on Elizabeth Warren, how she did. Some of the analysis I'm reading today is that she escaped major blows, and that attack over, whether the middle class would see taxes go up was probably the worst of the blows she had to endure. Juana.
Yeah, that's right. I think that generally speaking, stylistically, Elizabeth Warren is a candidate who is fastidiously making sure that she doesn't punch at her rivals. She will draw distinctions on policy, but you're never going to see her go out and attack another candidate by name. Her campaign and she have said they're not interested in doing that. So you didn't see that happen last night. What we did see was her really drawing distinctions, talking about her plans and what she believes in and what she stands for. I do think on this issue of healthcare, it's one that her rivals are going to keep coming back to her on. She has said that, she's with Bernie Sanders. She believes in Medicare for all. She has not rolled out any kind of plan of her own, unlike someone like Kamala Harris, who also says she supports Medicare for all, but has put her own spin on it and still calling it by the same name. I think her rivals see an opportunity there because she hasn't put out her own plan to kind of really push her on some of the details, since she's not in the driver's seat on this one quite as much.
Beth, I was watching Elizabeth Warren in the post-show interviews, the post-debate show interviews, and she seemed positively glowing. It looked like she felt she had a good night. Who else would you say had a good night?
Well, Warren is a skilled debater, and I think it's noteworthy that as she has risen in the polls, everybody keeps expecting other candidates on the stage, some of those lower tier candidates, to go after her. And nobody really did. And even the Biden's efforts to sort of take a crack at her support for Medicare for All really didn't faze her much. She's extremely smooth on the debate stage, and that's certainly been to her advantage. I mean, Beto O'Rourke, I would say, also had a good night. He was very passionate around the issue of guns, as Juana mentioned. Will he be the Democratic nominee? I mean, he's way down in the polls right now, but he has certainly set a benchmark now about the discussion of guns. I mean, not every candidate's going to agree with him on taking away people's assault weapons, but he's put that on the table, and now that is something that is going to be discussed in these debates. I would say Julian Castro had a bad night, given that his attack on Biden, suggesting he had some age-related forgetfulness, probably will not go over super well with a lot of voters who may not necessarily embrace Joe Biden as their candidate, but feel positively toward him and appreciate his service and may not like that jab.
And he is backtracking on that today. Many of the fellow Democrats on the stage said they didn't like seeing that whatsoever. But while the Democrats were up there, President Trump was giving a speech to Republicans who were meeting in Baltimore. Of course, this is a city that he recently described as rat infested. Last night, he pointed to the low unemployment rate there among minorities.
That's a good debate point. As they hit me left and right, I'll say African-American unemployment is the lowest it's ever been. And just leave the stage. Say thank you very much. Good luck.
Juan, I know you were nearby covering that speech and maybe some of the protests that were going on around it. What did you learn about what the president was up to while the Democrats were attacking him?
Yeah, that's right. So this is the president's speech that he routinely makes to the Republican retreat, a gathering of lawmakers. What I heard outside of that hotel where he spoke in Baltimore's Inner Harbor was a lot of frustration from Baltimore residents about the fact that the president, he flew in, he went immediately to the hotel, he left. He didn't spend time talking to Baltimore residents in this community. They also took issue with something that Kevin McCarthy, the Republican leader in the House, said. He told reporters earlier in the day that President Trump is coming to Baltimore because he cares about the city, and that's the proof. And what I heard from a lot of voters who came out to this protest that drew several hundred people is that if the president cared about Baltimore, he wouldn't have said the things that he said, calling it a rat-infested place that no one wants to live. And also that he and his Republican lawmakers in the House and Senate, that they would pass legislation that would help cities like Baltimore that residents admit has a lot of challenges, but there are a lot of good people who choose to live and work there too.
Beth, just really quickly, just to wrap up. So the president was talking about the debate a little bit. How much did the debate talk about the president?
You know, there were some shots taken at the president. Certainly Kamala Harris, who in past debates was kind of more focused on other of her rivals on the stage, went right for President Trump in her opening statement and said that it's imperative for Democrats to prevail in the 2020 election. But other than that, I mean, no mention of impeachment, no mention of some of the things that could have come up about the president. The folks on that stage were really focusing on the issues and on themselves and each other.
All right, that's Beth Fooey, senior politics editor at NBC, and also Juana Summers, national political reporter for the Associated Press. Thanks to you both.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Mexico is speaking out against a strict new rule from the Trump administration that the Supreme Court allowed to proceed this week. It effectively bars most Central Americans from seeking asylum in the U.S., and it could impact tens of thousands of migrants. Mexico's foreign secretary yesterday called the U.S. Supreme Court's decision astonishing. Christopher Sherman is a Mexico City correspondent with the Associated Press. Christopher, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
And this so-called safe third country rule bars migrants from seeking asylum in the U.S. unless they've already applied in another country that they've passed through, essentially meaning that Mexico is going to have to shoulder a lot of these claims. Is that why the foreign secretary of Mexico is so unhappy with the Supreme Court this week?
Well, it's interesting. For months now, the Mexican government has been saying that it's been able to avoid a so-called safe third country agreement with the United States because it was allowing the United States to make asylum seekers wait in Mexico while their case was processed. Mm-hmm. This policy has been called Remain in Mexico. To date, since the beginning of the year, more than 40,000 migrants have made their applications at the U.S. border and then been sent back into Mexico to wait. Mexico generally thought that this would allow them to avoid the situation that you described. But with the Supreme Court decision this week, the U.S. has essentially unilaterally created this safe third country effect, arriving at basically the same result that the Mexico had been trying to avoid.
Hmm. And it's interesting because on other policies, you named one of them, Remain in Mexico, where the asylum seekers will wait in Mexico while they figure out what happens to their claims in the U.S. The Mexican government has agreed to the White House demands, including sending troops to Mexico's borders. How is that going?
It's been a process because when President Trump made a threat in late May to impose crippling tariffs on all Mexican imports, that's how we arrived at this deployment that you described of Mexico's newly formed National Guard. And it was originally created to be the solution to Mexico's very serious security problem. Last year, they had more murders in the country than at any time in at least the past 20 years. But now, Mexico announced that it would send a good portion of this newly created National Guard to try to enforce immigration and slow the flow of migrants traveling north from Central America.
Well, and now President Trump is praising Mexico for that, saying that it's a big reason why apprehensions at the U.S. border have dropped dramatically this summer. Does the deployment deserve credit for those numbers?
Yes, I think that it's absolutely been a factor. The foreign secretary was in Washington this week and said that the number of migrants arriving at the U.S. southern border in the past 3 months has dropped by 56%. The National Guard deployment has played a role in that. And as much as anything, I think, and this was part of the goal, was to dissuade migrants from leaving, to make it appear the journey was going to be more difficult. The National Guard has tried to contain the migrants in southern Mexico and make it less easy for them to transit Mexico to the northern border. And I think it is showing results.
Well, in this country, tough immigration policies have put a lot of stress on the detention centers along the border. What's it doing to the detention centers in Mexico?
Mexico, there's a city in the southern state of Chiapas, which borders Guatemala, called Tapachula, that's been in a very tense situation for months now, because as this containment policy has kept the migrants down there, some are in detention centers, many are camped outside, but it's making a very difficult situation. They've had to open other facilities at a fairground there. It's overwhelming the system. And the concern now with this latest policy that will effectively make it impossible for anyone other than Mexicans to request asylum at the U.S. southern border is that Mexico now will be forced to handle more of these asylum applications. The agency that handles those applications in Mexico has been overwhelmed for years. Mm. In 2013, for example, they received about 1,300 applications for asylum here in Mexico. This year, just through August, they've received more than 48,000. If the agency didn't have the support of the UN's refugee arm, it would have collapsed by now. It's supposed to process cases in 45 days, and it's taking months. Cases are carrying over from one year to the next. So it appears the situation will just get more difficult.
Is the Mexican government looking for some sort of concessions here, some sort of quid pro quo? We're reading from your reporting that they're asking U.S. agents, the U.S. government, to help stem the flow of guns south into Mexico. What can you tell us about that? Is it realistic?
Exactly. Mexico now, with these results in hand, showing they've reduced migration significantly in 3 months, wants Washington to do something to help out Mexico's biggest problem. They say, you know, as the U.S. considers immigration a top priority, Mexico considers its security situation a top problem. And a high percentage of the guns that are recovered at crime scenes here are traced back to the United States. So they have asked the U.S. government to step up outbound inspections at land crossings on the southern border, stop more cars, look for more guns. And through that, they hope that they can press the U.S. government to do something about the guns that really have fueled the violence here in Mexico for years.
That's Chris Sherman of the Associated Press speaking with us from Mexico City. Chris, thanks for your time.
Thank you.
And India is in the midst of an immigration controversy of its own. Nearly 2 million people there, many born in India, have been told that they're not citizens. This is happening in the northeastern state of Assam, where there are many Muslims originally from neighboring Bangladesh, and some say the government's move is targeting them. The BBC's Rajini Vaidyanathan joins us now from New Delhi. She's just back from Assam. And Rajini, a list was published last month of who is a citizen of this state. How did authorities make that list?
Everyone in Assam, every single person, some 32 million people, had to prove that they were Indian. The definition of being Indian by this particular exercise is someone who has been living, or the family have been living in India, in Assam specifically, from before the day in 1971 that Bangladesh declared independence. And so that has required people to prove with paperwork and documentation that they or their ancestors were living in India before that date in March 1971. Now, a lot of people that we met in Assam say they don't have that documentation, but that they are genuine Indian citizens. A lot of people, particularly low-income families in India, don't have records, don't keep records, birth certificates, other sort of documentation.
So what's in store for those people?
Well, I went to one of these centres where people learnt whether or not they had or hadn't made the list. There was a lot of fear. I spoke to people who said that they were Indian citizens, but for some reason they hadn't appeared on the list. And in some cases, some members of the family had appeared on the list and others hadn't. Perhaps a husband had and a wife hadn't, mm-hmm. because it all goes back to proving your family tree.
Now, Prime Minister Narendra Modi's Hindu nationalist government has been accused of persecuting Muslims, and officials in India say that this list is not targeting any one person from any one religion. But what can you tell us about the truth? Are there more Hindus or more Muslims on the citizenship list?
Well, there's a few things to say. I mean, nobody has an official list or record of the religious breakdown on the list. But what we know anecdotally is actually Hindus and Muslims have appeared on the list. But here's the big thing that it's worth pointing out. During the election campaign earlier this year, the Indian general election, a man named Amit Shah, party president of the BJP, who is now Home Minister here, pledged to expand this NRC, National Register of Citizens program, across India. He said he wanted to remove every quote unquote infiltrator from India. And in one speech, he even described illegal immigrants as termites, using very, very strong language there. As part of that, though, he also wrote a tweet saying effectively that he would give amnesty to people from certain faiths. He named Hindus, Sikhs, Buddhists, Jains, Christians, but there was no mention of Muslims.
Meanwhile, it must be agonizing for the people who wonder what their future is if they're not on the citizenship list.
Well, that is the key, because nobody really knows what happens to them. I've certainly spoken to a lot of people in my reporting there who are absolutely terrified because, yes, they get to appeal, but we don't know how long this appeal process will go on for. And there are already many people in Assam who have been declared foreigners under other processes. And so there are already around 1,000 people in Assam who are in detention centres declared illegal immigrants. There are already plans to build more detention centres. And when we were in Assam, we saw the foundations being laid for a new bespoke detention centre. The other thing, which is the end game, of course, in a lot of the conversations that people have in terms of politicians, is that these people need to, quote unquote, go back to the country that they believe, the officials believe they came from, which is, of course, in this case, Bangladesh. But the Bangladesh government has not said it's going to take anyone. So at the moment, these people are in limbo and there isn't really any clarity once they go through these appeal processes about what would happen to them. And I think that is what really underpins a lot of this, is the uncertainty that breeds that fear.
The BBC's Rajini Vaidyanathan speaking to us from New Delhi. Rajini, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me on the show.
This time of year, as temperatures start to fall in cooler climates across the country, many outdoor municipal pools close for the season. Michigan Radio's Doug Tribou visited one pool that stays open just a little longer for some very special swimmers.
On a warm, sunny afternoon last week, I went to one of Ann Arbor's city pools, knowing full well I would not be allowed to swim. That's the sound of some serious dog paddling, but the swimmer would probably just call it paddling if he could speak. He's a black lab that just retrieved a tennis ball from the deep end. Labor Day is the end of the human swimming season here at Burr Park, but then the pool stays open for two more days, and the only swimmers allowed are dogs. A few dozen canine customers in all shapes, colors, and sizes are here, some of them wearing little life jackets. Normally, the no running rule is strictly enforced, but good luck with that today. A fluffy black and white Australian Shepherd is racing around the outer edge of the place, and he's dry as a bone. His owner, Kim, and I chatted while we watched.
What's your dog's name?
Jimmy.
Now, I heard you saying Jimmy Buffett.
Yeah, call him Jimmy Buffett, Jimmy Johns, Jumanji, you know, just anything.
But
his name is really Jimmy Barker.
Yes, Kim's last name is Barker, and Jimmy is 7 years old.
Every year I mean to do this, and this year I put it on my calendar, and I'm like, we're doing it. I mean, I've never seen my dog swim before, and he's just so excited. Look at him just greeting all of the dogs, and yeah, hopefully eventually we'll be able to get him in the kiddie pool.
This is the 16th year Burr Park Pool has hosted its dog days. For city residents, it's $6 for the first dog and $3 for any additional dogs. David Lieber has a pair of golden retrievers named Indy and Ellie. I spied them jumping into the deep end together like a synchronized dive team. Lieber likes watching the less experienced swimmers in the wading pool normally reserved for toddlers.
And it's also nice to see other dogs watching the dogs that can swim and hopefully learning as well, because that's how our dogs learned, is by watching other larger dogs just sort of dive in.
And not surprisingly, I saw the Basset Hound over by the waiting pool. That seems like a safe play there.
Right, right. Because I think if they went in this one, it might go right to the bottom.
Emma Meese is the assistant facilities supervisor for the park. She says they drain the chlorinated water and refill the pool before the dog days so the pups don't have to swim in the same chemicals we do. I asked if the fur piles up in the filters.
Yes. We are constantly, I would say, every hour cleaning out the gutters because they are filled with hair. I'm not going to lie, it's kind of gross.
But Meese is a dog person, and her two dogs are running around out here, too. She's worked here for 8 years.
Today's actually my last day.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah.
Well, that's sort of nice to have the last day be the dog day.
These 2 days make the whole summer worth it. Not that I don't love working the whole summer, but it gets a little hot and tiring. But these last 2 days with all the dogs and seeing how much fun they have, it makes it all worth it.
Judging by all the wagging tails, the dogs seem to agree. And as I got ready to leave, I spotted Jimmy Barker, a.k.a. Jimmy Buffett, with his black and white fur soaking wet after his very first swim. For Here and Now, I'm Doug Tribou.
A little pause here to admire all those dog puns, Peter.
If my dogs went into that pool, they'd have a heart attack. A battle is underway between the state of California and the NCAA over a college athlete's right to fair pay. The NCAA sent a letter to California Governor Gavin Newsom this week, urging him to veto Senate Bill 206. The bill passed Wednesday, and if signed into law, it would allow college athletes to hire agents, get paid for the use of their name, and sign endorsement deals. Dennis McDonough is on the NCAA Board of Governors. He was also White House Chief of Staff under President Obama. Dennis, welcome to Here and Now.
Thank you very much, Peter. It's good to be with you.
Good to have you. And why are you calling on Governor Newsom to veto this law?
Well, we think that the law, the proposed bill here is not in the best interest of student athletes. You know, there's 500,000 student athletes in colleges across the country. Not all of them, but a good percentage of them are in college because of the pathway that athletics afforded them. I worry myself about the fact that this bill in one state in the country would end up undercutting that pathway. And at a time when it's already too expensive for so many families to send kids to college, I'd really hate to see this pathway go away.
At the same time, it is offensive to many athletes who, under the current rules, they can't make money promoting their life story. They sometimes can't even coach youth sports during the summer when it's their talents who are making billions of dollars for colleges and universities across the country. Why shouldn't they get a cut of the money?
Look, I think that it's a very legitimate question. And fact is that many of the rules that we're talking about were written in 1975. And so there's no doubt that the rules need to be updated. We're looking at that very closely at the moment to make sure that we can update those rules into the 21st century here in a way that allows student-athletes to have the same opportunities that other students have, which is in this new economy and in this new environment, to generate revenue where they can. We just want to make sure that it's tied to their academic experience and that it doesn't put California at a competitive advantage over the other 49 states in things like recruiting.
Okay, I know, as you say, the NCAA is working to write new rules of its own, and I gather they could be out as soon as next month. So what else can you tell me about that? Are you willing to make some concessions to the athletes? Will there be any allowances, say, for endorsement deals?
I don't want to get ahead of the work that's being done. We have a working group of the board that's looking at this hard, so I don't want to rule anything like an endorsement deal in or out. What I do want to say is that we're trying to make sure that the experience of the student athletes is similar to the experience of their classmates. You know, they're in this economy, they're YouTube influencers, they're using social media, they're getting opportunities to start businesses. I think it's reasonable for us to look at that for student athletes, too.
The letter says something that, frankly, some people are viewing as a threat, that athletes in California could be banned from championship games if the governor doesn't veto this law. Why go that far? Aren't you punishing the athletes for something that they're not really responsible for?
Well, look, I mean, it's a question. I don't know that it's meant to be a threat as much as it's a statement of fact, which is that if you have a situation where California has arguably a competitive advantage over the other 49 states in recruiting student athletes, then I think that it throws into question the fundamental fairness of the competition. And that's what we're focused on here. First and foremost, we're focused on the health and well-being of the student athletes. But then the championships are, you know, the NCAA and the country's way of manifesting that competition in the most fair way. And if California is operating under a different set of rules, that does not allow the competition to unwind fairly.
I'm sure you saw the tweet by LeBron James, who called this law in California a game changer. He said college athletes can responsibly get paid for what they do and the billions they create. Senator Bernie Sanders has tweeted his support for the bill. These are some pretty high-profile names. Do you think that the NCAA is losing the battle of public opinion on this issue?
I will say it's daunting to be on the other side of a tweet from LeBron, but we feel duty-bound to protect the system of college athletics that allows fair competition across 50 states, because I think it is an important pathway for people to get to college who wouldn't otherwise have the opportunity or be able to afford it. And we do know from all the social science data that the fastest pathway to economic mobility is with a college degree. So I want to make sure that whoever is on the other side of this, whether it's Senator Sanders or LeBron or Draymond Green or the California legislature, that Governor Newsom takes that into consideration before he signs the bill.
Let me just ask you to reflect on what it would be like if the shoe were on the other foot. I know you played football at St. John's University.
Yes.
Do you think the 20-year-old Dennis McDonough would feel the same way as you do now?
I'm not sure, but I'm not sure whether it's, you know, virtuous to not have a change of opinion or change of mind in those years. I mean, oftentimes hear that debate here in Washington that somehow you should have the same view over the course of your lifetime. If you don't, I think that should be a logical, rational, fact-based decision. But look, I'm not saying to you that I'm against them having the same kinds of opportunities that their classmates have. I just want to make sure that this unfolds in a way that a young 20-year-old defensive back from Minnesota who, like, really aspired to get to a national championship. We lost twice in the national semifinal, so I never got there. But I want everybody to have that chance. Not only that, I want everybody to have the chance that I did to get through 4 years of college, be able to afford it. And I think that's what this debate is about.
Well, you mentioned the conversations that politicians have in Washington. Before I let you go, I got to ask the man who once had a front row seat in the Oval Office as chief of staff for President Obama, what you think of the Democrats in 2020 and how that race is shaping up?
Well, I hasten to say here, I'm not espousing any particular view on behalf of the NCAA in this regard.
But right.
If you just see the ideas that are being proposed, the policies and the solutions that the Democrats are talking about, I think that you can't help but be excited. And I think to myself, boy, they've got a tall hill to climb here to get reelected. And so I guess the way I stack it up is, would I rather be us or would I rather be in the White House? And the answer to that is I'd rather be us.
Do you think Joe Biden is doing a good job defending President Obama's legacy as he comes under attack by more progressive wings of the party?
I was really surprised. I didn't watch the debate last night, but I read the coverage this morning. And what I saw was it kind of in the press was the kind of cross the board validation of the president's legacy. So I think the vice president is obviously doing his part in it, but I think the legacy speaks for itself. You know, there was that aberration in the second debate a couple weeks ago where a couple of candidates did attack the president's legacy, but I think the evidence is that people are recognize the strength of the legacy themselves.
Do you think a progressive like Elizabeth Warren or Bernie Sanders can beat President Trump?
I think that any Democrat can beat President Trump.
All right. That's Dennis McDonough, former White House chief of staff under President Obama, now a member of the NCAA Board of Governors. Mr. McDonough, thanks very much for your time.
Thanks so much, Peter. I really appreciate it.
Well, one issue facing students, whether they're athletes or not, is student loan debt. That was the topic of a hearing in the House Financial Services Committee this week that included testimony from comedian Hasan Minhaj. Minhaj brought jokes but made serious points as he told members of Congress about an experience he had taping an episode of his Netflix series, Patriot Act.
Now, we recently did an episode on the student loan crisis, and it really hit home with our audience because 44 million Americans owe more than $1.6 trillion of student loan debt. In fact, the day we shot our episode, we polled our studio audience. It was only about 200 people. In that room alone had over $6 million of student loan debt. Now, granted, our audience is mainly unemployed poli-sci majors, but that's still a lot of money.
Minaj implored the committee to regulate what he called predatory for-profit loan servicing companies.
Now, look, we know the deck is stacked against student borrowers in ways that it wasn't 10 or even 15 years ago. And they deserve some basic protections. Americans should not have to go bankrupt pursuing higher education. And they should never be preyed upon by under-regulated loan servicing companies. So members of this committee, we know the government is capable of stepping in during a financial crisis. So really all I'm asking today is, why can't we treat our student borrowers the way we treat our banks? Because 44 million Americans, that is too big to fail. Thank you so much for your time, and I will now go back to where I came from.
Comedian Hasan Minhaj testifying before Congress this week. The Trump administration says its repeal of an Obama-era rule that protects wetlands and waterways is just the first step in rewriting Clean Water Act regulations. Here is EPA Administrator Andrew Wheeler speaking at yesterday's signing ceremony.
When President Trump took office, he immediately set in motion a process to remove and replace regulatory burdens that were stifling American innovation and economic development. The Obama administration's 2015 Waters of the U.S. definition was at the top of the list.
Joining us now is Ariel Wittenberg, a reporter covering water for E&E News. Ariel, you were right there in the middle of the ceremony. Who else was there?
Yeah, sure. So there, of course, was Administrator Wheeler and officials from the Army Corps of Engineers. But there were also members of the manufacturing industry, of the agricultural industry, of the energy industry, and the housing development industry, all of whom have been pushing not only for this rollback, which was finalized yesterday, but also the coming rollback, which will, you know, roll back clean water protections that have been in place since the 1980s.
So this week's rollback, what does it apply to exactly? Just lay it out for us, nice and simply.
Right. So I think most people would be surprised to learn that when Congress wrote the Clean Water Act in 1972, they never really settled the question of what water they're talking about. The act just says the words that it applies to waters of the United States. And so for the past 40 years, there's been this fight over, well, okay, what does that mean? And so, you know, it's kind of obvious if you're thinking about, you know, the Chesapeake Bay or the Potomac River. But when we're talking about, you know, the creeks and the streams that lead into the Potomac or the wetlands that filter water that goes into the Potomac or things like that, that's where, you know, you have these gray areas that there have been these really long protracted legal fights over. And this question has been actually to the Supreme Court three times and very likely will end up there again as a result of the Trump administration's actions today.
So before these rules went into place, what were these areas of water that were sort of unregulated? What did they look like? What was it like?
Right. So before the Clean Water Act went into place, there was what we called the Federal Pollution Control Act, and it basically set standards for water bodies of here's what our water quality should look like, but it didn't really have a great way of controlling that. So the Clean Water Act was the first federal legislation to say, we're going to permit pollution at the source. We're going to control it. So if you want to stick a wastewater discharge pipe into a river, we're going to control how much pollution is in it or how much you have to clean it up. Or if you want to build a housing development on a bunch of wetlands, we're going to control, you know, how you're going to offset that destruction to make sure that the environment doesn't get too damaged by that.
So for Americans, what difference will this rollback make?
So this rollback will make a difference depending on where you live. There are specific types of wetlands, particularly Texas prairie wetlands, vernal pools, which are common in California, Carolina and Delmarva Bays, which are particularly vulnerable to the rollback that we had today. But the rollback that we're expecting the administration to finalize this winter will affect 51% of wetlands nationwide, more so in the West, and at least 18% of streams nationwide, again, more so in the West. So this really will end up affecting most Americans if step one and step two are ultimately completed.
You had a little gaggle with Andrew Wheeler during the ceremony or after the ceremony. What was that like?
Right. So he was there to take questions from reporters, which was very kind of him. And, you know, there were questions about, well, how do you know that this is going to stand up in court? Because the Trump administration is almost certainly going to be sued over this by both environmental groups and also states' attorneys general. And he kind of said, well, I hope everybody reads the rule before they start suing us. One thing that is important to note is actually this rollback actually will only matter in half of the states in the country, because due to various legal challenges, this Obama-era regulation has only been in effect in 22 states. And so it's obviously very important in the states that it has been in effect, but I really would stress that the major change is what we're expecting in the coming months, because last December, the administration put out a proposal for their new definition of waters of the United States, and they will no longer be regulating streams or rivers that only flow after rainfall, which, you know, on the East Coast, we don't have a lot of those. But if you're in Arizona, that can be either teeny tiny streams or even major rivers that will only flow after rainfall. But that rainfall contributes a lot downstream, and that's a very important water source to the folks who live there. Additionally, the proposed rule would mean that the Clean Water Act would only apply to wetlands with relatively permanent surface water connections to waterways. So a wetland would basically have to be right next to a river or a stream in order to be protected under that proposal.
Ariel Wittenberg is a reporter covering water for E&E News. Ariel, thank you.
Thanks.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Femi Okeh.
And I'm Peter O'Dowd. This is Here and Now.